Program. My name is Mike Malloy. Glad you're here. This hour is sponsored by Andrew Welch. He has a message. The Malloy Show must continue if democracy is due. If democracy. All right, let's start. Can you start the music again? No, Andrew Welch is the sponsor this hour. The Malloy Show must continue if democracy is to. Mike never apologizes for raising your voice when you speak the truth. All right, thank you, Andrew. I want to digress from the horror that is occurring in Japan. If you've been following this as I have, there's not a whole lot I can add. And not a whole lot that we can add on this program. It is getting total coverage, global coverage, as well it should. It is a monster of a catastrophe. It is beyond anything, I think, from what I've heard, beyond anything that we have encountered since the nuclear age began. There are other things occurring in this country, and I want to address some of those. We will be touching here and there tonight on the situation in Japan. As a matter of fact, I have a guest tonight. His name is Russ Baker. He has a website you may be familiar with. He's the editor at whowhatwhy.com. It's an investigative news website. He's also the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He'll join us in about an hour. And again, there is just nothing that I can add. And I said last night that the whole issue was beginning to frighten the hell out of me. That is still true tonight. But there is just nothing to add right now. The situation is horrendous. If there is any so-called breaking news, we will do that tonight. The only thing I want to cover on this, a couple of related situations here, and they're in the form of emails from a couple of people. An email from Craig in St. Paul, Minnesota. He writes, it's really very simple. Some things just simply should not be operated for a profit. While capitalism may be a great and powerful economic engine, it is a lousy system of moral values. When I was a boy growing up in Southern California, I remember in the fifth grade we built a scale model of a nuclear reactor. We learned all about fuel rods in the giant containment vessel and how all of the clever engineers and mathematicians had made sure the plant was so safe that it could be built on a public beach at San Onofre. Don't send me a pronouncer on that again. I'm tired of screwing it up. There were stories of a future where nuclear power would make electricity so cheap that there would be no need for electric meters. The lesson was capped off with a day-long trip to the San Onofre construction site where we saw firsthand the concrete and rebar dome going up. And we learned to pronounce nuclear with only two syllables. The lesson plan and the materials were provided by Southern California Edison. a regulated public utility operated in the public interest, and therein lies the problem. Nuclear power requires a careful balance between the benefits and the risks. When the nuclear plants in this country were built 40 years ago, they were usually built by public utilities, which, thanks to their position as regulated monopolies, had the ability to tip the scales away from profit in favor of the public interest. But beginning with the Reagan Revolution, we began the sale of public utilities to corporate interests, where the cost-benefit analysis is very different. Will it produce a bottom-line profit? Can we make the case that it is at least not illegal? If so, let's go. That was the attitude. The rules of the so-called marketplace are clear. There are no moral judgments, only shareholder value. Now, all those nuclear reactors, which were designed to operate safely for 40 years and then be retired, are reaching the end of their useful life. The plan, back when they were built, was to take them out of service at this point. But now the plants are owned by for-profit corporations whose only interest is in squeezing a few more dollars out of their investment. How many times has the Nuclear Regulatory Commission refused to extend the operating license of an aging nuclear plant? Not once. I'm very sorry for what is happening in Japan, but it was inevitable. Craig in St. Paul. And Sherry in New Jersey. Right, Mike, last night in the third hour, I sent you a quick email telling you that the nuclear reactors in Japan were made by GE and that there were 23 of the same models in the U.S. Below is a link to that list. I mistakenly said in the email that they were built in the 50s. I meant the 70s. However, there is a plant here in South Jersey that was built in 1969. They told us in 2010 that in 2009, the reactor was leaking tritium, a highly radioactive material, and it was heading for the aquifer that serves all of South Jersey. See the link below for that story. And now they've decided to close it 10 years earlier. What about now? It's about money, of course. Check that link below. Are they crazy? Do these people from corporations and government think that somehow they're immune to all this? Do you think they have a gated community already for them on the moon? I am the owner of a wig shop. Get the image of Coke bottle glasses and permed blue hair out of your head. I opened it 7 years ago thinking that our boomer generation is middle-aged and beyond, and wigs would become the new thing. That has come to fruition. They don't want anyone to know. Anyway, what I didn't expect was all the cancer. It never entered my mind when I decided to do this. I was told that the incidence of breast cancer is the highest along the East Coast from New Jersey to New York. I have people from Philly and the shore areas coming here. About 60% of my business is because of hair loss from chemotherapy, and the women are getting younger. I had a 28-year-old customer this year and a 30-year-old customer last week. There are more in the late 30s category, and 95% are ill with breast cancer. New Jersey, mostly the north, has all kinds of chemical plants that have been spewing who knows what into the air forever. The underground waste barrels leak. There was a big lawsuit last year about one site that was leaking before they built the expensive housing developments around that area. There are at least four or five townships and boroughs, one of which is my borough, I found out, who send their garbage to this location. I lived a mile from it for 10 years before I moved to this borough, and I'm sure the tritium is leaking away in the aquifer. So all our townships and boroughs are impacted from that. Cancer is just another business. When the pink ribbon people contact me, I tell them to use the money to clean up the environment. Running for the cure. Huh. How about cleaning for the cure? The CEO of the American Cancer Society makes around $500,000 a year. Where does that money really go? So our community should be beefing up their immune systems and thyroids regardless of the tragedy in Japan. And perhaps your family and your listeners should too. Wouldn't hurt. The government will never tell you the truth and will never clean it up. Kind of like the Gulf of Mexico. We are on our own. Sherry, New Jersey. The hour. And again, this hour is being sponsored by Andrew Welsh. Thanks, Andrew. This may be the last thing that I get to directly about the situation in Japan tonight. Prairie 2. Title, The Economics of a Pegged Needle on the Geiger Counter. Bruce writes, the Dow dropped another 240 points today as concerns about Japan's crisis weighs on the transnational companies that dominate the index's listings. The U.S. dollar has gained against the yen, but is still weak against the euro, reflecting the oil market, as most oil is still traded in dollars. And while the price of oil is down, speculation still dominates. Keep in mind, the Federal Reserve is putting something on the order of 120 billion U.S. dollars into the markets every month, or you would likely see the Dow fall through the floor. Japan's central bank has been pumping massive amounts of yen to keep their markets from melting down. A bad pun, I know, but it is a reasonable analogy, just the same as Japan's economy now teeters on the edge of oblivion. Japan has been competing, quote-quote, in the world market by monopolizing the production of hundreds of critical electronic and industrial components. Much of this production is concentrated in the part of Japan now devastated and facing total abandonment without some sort of miracle at the nuclear plants. The U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission official under oath before Congress today testified that the Japanese are either understating the crisis or are unaware of the magnitude. The U.S. NRC says the radiation is already at lethal levels around the reactor site, and this is not just guesswork, as the U.S. is big in the spy satellite business. We have the capacity to track nuclear radiation emissions with a high degree of accuracy. Germany has ordered the immediate shutdown of all its nuclear plants based on the GE Mark I design. Three GE engineers resigned their jobs when these time bombs were being built over the stupidity of their design. The 36 GE Mark I reactors in the U.S. have the very same waste fuel rod cooling pools on top of the reactor building with basically no shielding. Any long-term failure of the cooling system will result in a complete meltdown and metallic fire, regardless of whether these plants are even in operation. GE stock was down 3.37% today, double the market drop. Not that they will ever be held accountable for their negligence. Companies this size never are. But they are not a U.S. company anymore, and the collapse of Japan, where much of their business is based, will hurt their bottom line. GE's partner in Japan is Hitachi, which holds an 80% stake and will bear the brunt of the responsibility for the disaster if anyone is held to account. China, not being run by fools, has ordered the immediate halt of all nuclear plant construction. President Obama is still paying lip service to the nuclear industry, saying it is essential for our future. Japan's, and especially the foreign money elites there, have bought up all corporate jet leases to ferry their people out of the country. The future, while often murky, comes to complete clarity if your Geiger counter pegs the needle at the top of the scale. And for all you people who think my references to canned goods are a joke, the stores in Tokyo are now empty. PrairieNumeral2.com. I would hope, and this is a hollow hope, because Barack Obama has demonstrated who his constituency really is. Do you have that tape handy? Or that sound, not tape. Jesus, why do I keep saying tape? Do you have that bit of audio? That digital audio ready? We'll play it when we come back. But anybody who is counting on the intense, focused, determined leadership that we need right now in this country, there's two things you must realize. This president and the legislative branch taken together are incapable of providing that leadership. That's A. Here's B. The system that we use in this country that has been so totally corrupted by corporate America is no longer operative. We have had our own political meltdown in this country that has been going on for 30 years. It is now accomplished. So anybody out there who still believes that the system can be changed either is a right-wing fox-eating freak or hasn't been paying attention. The system cannot be improved. It cannot be changed. It must be replaced. We'll be right back.
Could I do? Remember that unity starts with you.
Hold on. Hold on.
Hold on. Is democracy dead? Only time's gonna tell. Get your feet in the street and start raising some hell.
Hold on. Hold on.
Hold on. Your sisters and brothers, keep your eyes on the prize.
He's a liberal with a microphone, and that makes him dangerous. It's Mike Malloy.
This hour is sponsored by Andrew Welch. Thank you, Andrew. Coming up at the top of the next hour here, Russ Baker, who is the editor at whowhatwhy.com. If you haven't gone to the website, check it out. It's an investigative news website, and Russ also is the author of the book, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. While this tragedy is occurring, this global tragedy, it's not just Japan's tragedy, some things are happening in the Republican-dominated state legislatures around this country that these filthy Republicans are hoping is slipping under the radar. For the most part, it really is slipping under the radar. This one just about freaked me out. Missouri State Senator Jane Cunningham, a Republican, is pushing a bill that apparently she has written. Well, it's being entered under her name. She probably didn't write it. I'm sure it was written by her corporate master. But the bill would dramatically take away state child labor protections. Child labor now. Here's a summary of the bill. This act modifies the child labor laws. It eliminates the prohibition of employment of children under age 14. Eliminates it. Restrictions on the number of hours and restrictions on when a child may work during the day also are removed. It also repeals the requirement that a child age 14 or 15 obtain a work certificate or work permit in order to be employed. All this stuff is to be thrown out. Children under 16 also will be allowed to work in any capacity in a motel, resort, or hotel where sleeping accommodations are furnished. It also removes the authority of the director of the Division of Labor Standards to inspect employers who employ children and require them to keep certain records for children they employ. Gone. All to be removed. It also repeals the presumption that the presence of a child in a workplace is evidence of employment. Gone. Gone. Now, children in Missouri, if this passes, would still have the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act to fall back on, which has some prohibitions against the sort of thing that this crazy bitch in Miami has decided to remove from the law books. But far-right lawmakers have declared war on federal child labor laws as well. In a lengthy lecture delivered before his election to the U.S. Senate, Mike Lee, Republican of Utah, praises a discredited 1918 Supreme Court decision declaring child labor laws unconstitutional. See, back in the bad old days, 1918, child labor laws unconstitutional. This scum bastard in Utah, Mike Lee, praises that decision, says, hey, that's the way it should be. Put the little bastards to work. You know, you can get a kid for $3 an hour or a day. That decision, which this thug, this punk, Mike Lee, holds out a model for his vision of the Constitution, was unanimously overruled by the Supreme Court in 1941. But never mind. And as recently as the day before Obama moved into the White House, it was difficult to imagine even the most conservative lawmakers breaking with a 70-year-old consensus surrounding child labor laws. Welcome to the post-Tea Party era, where even the most bizarre and disastrous mistakes from America's past are part of the right wing's agenda. Can you believe this? It is happening right before your eyes, Truesager. Right before your eyes. There's more. Oh, my God, there's more. Michigan's Republican governor has slashed corporate tax rate by 86% and put tax increases on the working poor. And the person who sent this to me says this is what happens when you don't vote. This is from Think Progress. Several conservative governors have proposed placing the brunt of deficit reduction onto the backs of their state's public employees, students, and middle-class taxpayers, while simultaneously trying to enact corporate tax cuts and giveaways. Rick Scott, Florida, Corbett, Pennsylvania, Brewer of Arizona have all gone down this road. Following suit, Rick Snyder, Michigan, has proposed ending his state's earned income tax credit, cutting a $600 per child tax credit, taking it away, and reducing credits for seniors, while also cutting funding for school districts by up to 10%. At the same time, as the Michigan League for Human Services found, the state's business taxes would be reduced by nearly $2 billion, or 86%. Under Snyder's plan, quote, business taxes would be cut by 86% from an estimated $2.1 billion in fiscal year 2011 to $292 million in fiscal year 2013, the first full year of the proposed tax changes. Taxes on individuals from the state income tax would rise by $1.7 billion, or nearly 31%. As the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy found, the practical upshot of Snyder's tax increases is to place even more of a burden on Michigan's poorest residents, who will see a bigger hike than those at the upper end of the income scale. Michigan already has a regressive tax system, which Snyder's proposal will only make worse. Currently, someone in the poorest 20% of Michigan taxpayers pays a tax rate of 8.9%. while someone in the richest 1% pays 5.3%. In addition to trying to make an unfair tax system even worse for Michigan's low-income residents, Snyder has also asked that the state be given the power to dismiss local governments and appoint emergency so-called town managers who could break contracts and strip power from elected officials. We talked about this the other night. Do you see what these son of a bitches are doing? How much longer, Truth Seeker? Let me tell you something. The thought did occur to me today. What would happen? Let's supposing we had an invader that came to this country and started to destroy our homes, our jobs. Supposing this invader found out we had insurance policies and tore it up and flushed it into the mud. Supposing this invader said to us, "You got kids in school? Tough. Too bad. We're closing the school." What if they said, "Oh, you had collective bargaining where you get together and decide how much you're going to be"? No, no more of that. What would we do if an invader came here, in other words, and started imposing fascism? I would pick up a gun and defend my country until I was shot dead. What would you do, Truth Seeker? Would you sit back on your ass and allow it to happen? If you're a Social Security recipient, I don't care how old you are. You can be in your 70s. You're still healthy. You can still pick up a weapon, right? What would you do if an invader came to this country and said to you, "We're slashing your Social Security"? What would you do if the same invader said, "We're reducing your Medicare to the point where it becomes superfluous. It doesn't mean anything"? What would you say if you had small children and this invader said, "No more kindergarten, no more pre-K. If you don't like it, send your child to a religious school. It's over"? If all this started happening, what would you do, Truth Seeker? Would you get off your ass and fight? And I don't mean fight by signing a petition online. I mean literally fight. Would you do that? I goddamn sure would and will. Now, this is what's going on in this country. There apparently is an invader who is destroying everything, even taking away what little bit of representation we still have left that's ballot or that's valid that comes out of the ballot box. That's even been tampered with. But now, this crazy son of a bitch governor in Michigan wants to take that away too. What are you going to do about it?
no more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour, and this hour has been sponsored by Andrew Welch. Writes, Mike, never apologize for raising your voice when you speak the truth. All right, thanks, Andrew. An update on the Missouri story from Reg at TVNewsLies.org. State Senator Jane Cunningham has decided to drop her controversial bill to repeal Missouri's child labor laws. You can bet your ass that's temporary. Her office provided little explanation as to why it decided to end its pursuit of the legislation. A spokesman for the state senator said, quote, the bill is dead. It's no longer an issue, end quote. After a reading last month, the bill had remained stalled in the Senate. It had not picked up a co-sponsor. Wonder why. So for tonight, it's dead. But a Republican woman senator in the state of Missouri proposed an end to all child labor laws, the gutting of any oversight agencies that keep track of that sort of thing. You think it's dead? You think nobody else is going to pick it up? I think progress has been documenting these efforts in Republican-dominated states now to shift the burden of these record financial shortfalls, in other words, the bankruptcy of these states, onto middle-class Americans, while at the same time doling out tax cuts to corporations. At Think Progress, Paul Breer and Kevin Donahoe have put together a fairly concise report here. Progressive governors have proposed raising revenue from those who can afford it, you know, tax the rich. Alongside some painful cuts to programs, Republican governors have unveiled budgets that cut taxes for corporations and raise them on the middle class and working poor. New Jersey. Last year, Governor Christie's budget raised taxes on the working poor and middle class by cutting the state's earned income tax credit and homestead rebates, and yet still found money for lucrative corporate tax cuts. This year, Christie's budget calls for $200 million in business tax cuts, while cutting mental health services, cutting $500 million from Medicaid, cutting property tax rebates for seniors, until public workers give up their health and pension benefits. New Jerseyans have said they prefer a tax on millionaires. Governor Christie gives them the finger. Michigan, Rick Snyder, I just told you about. The plan cuts taxes on businesses by more than 86% while slashing $1.2 billion in funding for schools, universities, local governments, and, quote, other areas. Snyder also wants to raise personal taxes by 30%, which will fall disproportionately on Michigan's lowest income residents. Georgia. Last week, the Georgia House passed a budget that will increase health insurance costs by more than 20% for state workers, teachers, and retirees, and cut funding for state universities by $75 million. The House here in Georgia has already gutted the state's HOPE scholarship program and is now considering implementing a regressive new tax system that would lower income taxes for the rich, while raising the sales tax on basic necessities. House Majority Leader Larry O'Neill, Republican scumbag, has introduced a bill that would implement a flat income tax rate and cut corporate taxes by 33%. You see how this goes? Florida, Tea Party rally last month, Rick Scott, the filthy governor there, unveiled his budget, telling supporters he would make the state, quote, the most fiscally conservative in the nation, end quote. The budget would slash corporate income and property taxes, lay off 6,700 state employees, cut education funding by $4.8 billion, and cut Medicaid by $4 billion. Ohio. John Kasich, the punk bastard governor there, has proposed cutting 25% of schools' budgets, $1 million from food banks, $12 million from children's hospitals, $15.9 million from an adoption program for children with special needs. A Kasich staffer revealed yesterday that these cuts are more about politics than budget balancing, telling the Cincinnati Dispatch that, quote, even if there weren't an $8 billion deficit, we'd probably be proposing many of the same things, end quote. The plan includes tax cuts for oil companies, a repeal of the estate tax, and an income tax cut for the rich that former Governor Ted Strickland, a Democrat, stopped last year because of the state's fiscal crisis. Are you listening to me? It goes on and on. If somebody invades this country and starts to steal everything from our old people, from our middle class people, from our poor people, from our children, from our university students, from our public employees, what would you do? What would you do, truth seeker, about that invader? Would you fight? Would you resist? Would you do something other than sign an online petition? What would you do? Please, you don't have to answer. Just think about it. Just think about it. We'll be back after the break. We're going to be joined by Russ Baker. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Jay Farner here.
It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy Program. This hour is sponsored by Barry Hall, who has a message to Dolores, Molly, and Sylvester with love. Barry Hall is the sponsor of this hour. Thanks, Barry. And earlier in the program, I mentioned to you the website whowhatwhy.com, an investigative news website that's run by Russ Baker. He's the editor there. He's also the author of a book a lot of you are very familiar with, Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. I want to share with you here before we bring Russ onto the program something that's at his website right now. Russ writes this: anyone watching the devastation of Japan must certainly wonder what we as individuals should be doing to help. For some insight, we turn to Richard Walden, a most unusual leader of a most unusual humanitarian relief group called Operation USA. His organization's efforts are well known to whowhatwhy.com, and they tend to be practical and modest and effective. In a just-published item on Huffington Post, Richard cuts against the conventional mass reaction to a crisis like this. We reprint his remarks here in their entirety. Now, it's not a long article. It's what we can do now for Japan. Richard writes, the armies of fundraising, such as the American Red Cross, slick televangelists, and their front organizations claiming to do relief, professional international relief groups and small private groups of concerned Americans wanting to help are off the mark quickly in the Japan quake tsunami radiation disaster. Efforts ranging from sophisticated internet and text-in donation appeals to using paid television and radio programming to holding drive-by drop-offs at the Roseville in Pasadena, California, will raise hundreds of millions again as they did in Haiti. Alas, the long-term results will likely not be much better. The Japanese government has, as of early Monday morning Tokyo time, not gone far beyond asking the U.S. Navy and three U.S.-based fire department rescue teams to come and help in the rescue operation. Japan has plenty of doctors and nurses, a large pharmaceutical industry, involved corporations, and an efficient, if small, military with modern resources. As it happened after Kobe in 1995, the earthquake then there, the Japanese government and the high-saving Japanese people will lead much of the rescue, relief, and recovery effort. International aid beyond the rescue phase will hopefully target overlooked communities, often seniors and non-Japanese resident aliens, as Operation USA did with a modest amount of medical supplies and money in Kobe. The U.S. dollar is close to an all-time low against the Japanese yen, so donors' money won't go as far as it did in Haiti or in the South Asian tsunami of 2004. I urge the donating public to take it slowly and deliberately. Reactive donations only to the American Red Cross or to some televangelist-led group tend not to be the wisest choices. Japan has its own excellent Red Cross health system with hospitals, clinics, and much more, most with heavy Japan government funding. For you faith-based donors, Japan is Buddhist, so you will not be converting Japanese to Jesus anytime soon. Better to carefully sort through relief agencies' descriptions of what they plan to do over the next month or next month to 2 years in Japan to help it recover. Look for gaps to fill. A small school or clinic in an out-of-the-way village might need funds or bulk supplies. And then there's a website here, opusa.org. opusa.org. And joining us now from New York is Russ Baker. Hey, Russ.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I'm doing fine. Several of the people that knew you were going to be on tonight emailed me and said they've been to your website and really appreciate the process that you use to put information out there for people, the news stories, and frankly, I've used it myself. I always credit writers and websites, but you know what it's like now with this inundation of not just news events but sources to get information. Just briefly, whowhatwhy.com. Who is it? What's your function and why? Oh gosh, I just made it funny.
Well, we are a nonprofit, started several years ago gradually while I was working on my book, Family of Secrets, kind of almost on the side. We have a large group of people, kind of an amorphous group, who help out however they can, basically pro bono, voluntarily. We are in the process of trying to raise money from the public and from private donors who support what we do. And basically, our mission is the why. You know, in journalism school, they teach you who, what, when, where, why, and how. Obviously, who and what are the first two. And then we go right to why, because why seems to us the most crucial question.
Mm-hmm.
And so our mission is to not be partisan and not be strictly advocating for a particular position, but on the other hand, not be like the kind of namby-pamby thing we get so much from the corporate-funded media, where they're reluctant to really say anything conclusive.
Mm-hmm.
Our objective is to try to be kind of like detectives for the people, to go out, assess the situation without an agenda, and come back and say, okay, we looked at this thing, and here's what we think is going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the short relatively short article that I just read here from Richard Walden is an example of that. The first reaction, and I know it comes from the heart, but the first reaction of people when these horrendous events occur is to do something, anything, but do something. And it's in those moments, of course, when the thugs, the thieves, the liars, the charlatans can just make a fortune. I don't know how many emails I've already gotten that bypass my spam filter, asking for a donation for such and such a relief organization that for sure is going to help the poor people of Japan. And I think when I read Richard's article, I said, you know, I had not thought about that in exactly that way. Of course, one should hesitate for just a moment, take a breath. Japan, I mentioned this the night it happened, though. Japan is not Haiti. Japan is, the third or fourth largest economy on Earth. It is an industrialized country that is homogeneous and therefore able to work as a unit rather than all these divergent groups that you find in so many other societies.
That's correct. In fact, the Japanese culture is one where people do help each other.
Right.
And their government is much more involved in all facets of life than our government is. So they're not as dependent in general on charity. And, of course, you know, our reaction, and since Richard wrote that and since we posted that, of course, the situation in Japan has gotten much graver.
Right.
And more terrifying. But you know, so, of course, what happens is that a kind of paralysis sets in, and we all, you know, sort of start panicking and wondering what we can do. But as Richard points out, usually in these situations, I mean, it's not clear what you can do. And so you want to be thoughtful about it. And rather than just responding to whoever has the biggest bullhorn, and, you know, the American Red Cross actually has been involved in a series of controversies. There have been investigations and scandals. And so we don't need to, at face value, just accept their claim that they're the people to give the money to. Certainly the televangelists, a lot of these religious groups have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to look at, I mean, the thing I like about Operation USA, and there are other groups too, there are, you know, quite a few of them, that are really pretty selfless, don't have any kind of overt agenda. I know they've got extremely low overhead. Their offices are very, very simple. You compare mm-hmm. that to some of these other outfits, which really, you know, pay their executives huge amounts and so on. This is not the case there. And they look for those things. They look for, as he says, out-of-the-way places where, mm-hmm. where nobody else is paying any attention.
Yeah. Hey, Russ, can you hold on a second? We have to do some commercials here, right?
Sure.
We'll be right back. We're talking with Russ Baker. He is the editor of WhoWhatWhy.com, an investigative news website. He's also the author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Stay with us. The hour. We're talking with Russ Baker, who is the editor at the site WhoWhatWhy.com, also the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. If you want more information about Russ, there's two ways you can do it. Go to his website and take a look at the staff that is writing for this site. Also, just go to Wikipedia and type in Russ, not Russell, Russ Baker. And you'll get more stuff than you can possibly handle. Family of Secrets, if you don't mind, I know that's been out for what? How many years has it been since you published that?
A couple of years now.
Two? Three?
Two.
I think it has certainly got a lot of publicity when it came out. What prompted you to write Family of Secrets?
The short story is that I couldn't figure out what George W. Bush and his rise and the things that he did meant. And I just wondered if there was not some deeper explanation of all of that. A lot of the work that I do, and I think the work that we're trying to do at Who, What, Why, is to not assume that we know the answer to things, but to ask the question. And actually, at the time of the invasion of Iraq, I was living in the former Yugoslavia in Serbia, had been asked to go over there and train journalists there in investigative reporting, and I was being barraged with questions about what had happened to America. And I realized that something profound had happened and that we didn't have a good explanation. So when I got back in 2004, I began traveling the country asking those questions. And the more I dug, the more I saw it wasn't just how he had been able to become the most powerful person in the world, but what about all those people and all that big money that wanted him in? I mean, there were so many other people they could have had who also would have been sympathetic to their economic interests, but it was him. And so it really was about him and his family, not just his father, who, of course, also had been president, but the grandfather, the great-grandfather, and the interests that they were deeply entwined with and represented. And so I just began digging. Didn't find a whole lot for the first year or two. I spent 5 years doing the research and writing for Family of Secrets. But after a couple of years, I suddenly started finding some pushing on some doors that opened. And then pretty soon, I went down vertically, right down the rabbit hole. And that's where all this amazing stuff came out.
How much of a negative impact did this George W. Bush's presidency, that 8 years that we obviously were unable to survive, how big of an impact do you think those 8 years have had on this country in a negative sense?
Well, I think it changed us for a long time in the future, maybe forever. It basically shifted the debate substantially. And if you compare, for example, the things that he did with even the things that Ronald Reagan did, Reagan turns out to have been much more moderate in mm-hmm. that respect. And then, of course, Richard Nixon, a flaming liberal by comparison.
Right.
And so we saw the ball move so far to the right that you can have people now like Obama, who is the, you know, so-called liberal democratic opposition, who starts from a position that is so far away from where that would have been just a few short years before, and things that we just take for granted, like why is Obama's defense secretary the same one who was mm-hmm. Bush's defense secretary? We don't even question these things anymore. I could go on for an hour listing the profound changes that have taken place on every level of our government and of our society.
I think the most shocking thing to a lot of people who supported Obama, even reluctantly, and I number myself among that group, it won't happen again, but it did happen in the last presidential election. But the profound disappointment came when it became clear that Obama was not only going to continue so many of the far-right policies of George W. Bush, but he was going to enhance them. He was going to blow them up a little, make them a little bit more more effective and or more repressive, I should say. And the shock, I think, came, and I've talked about this on the program here many times, not so much that Obama turned out to be something that we who voted for him never expected, but the fact that we who voted for him cast him in a certain light that he never was. I mean, he never made any claims. He made promises, yes. He made promises that turned out to be absolute and direct lies. But he made no claims about his overall political agenda or his political point of view. It was those of us who voted for him that did that. Can you hold on another second, Russ?
Sure.
All right, let me put you on hold. We'll come back. We're talking with Russ Baker. He's the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. He is also the editor at whowhatwhy.com, a news website that if you haven't checked out, please do it. We'll be right back.
Watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malone.
25 before the hour. We're talking with Russ Baker, who is the editor of whowhatwhy.com and the author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Russ, given the profound effect, as far as I'm concerned, all negative, that the Bush administration, or as I've referred to them for 10 years, the Bush crime family, affected in this country, is, do you think the system that has been faltering, I'm talking about neoliberal capitalism coupled with our system of representative democracy, is it broken? I frankly think it is. I think, frankly, it's broken beyond repair. What do you say?
Well, I might have had a different answer before I did the research for Family of Secrets. What I discovered was so alarming to me, and I'm speaking as someone with a bachelor's degree in political science and a master's degree in journalism, who has worked in politics and in business and so forth, many things over the years. I thought I understood how things worked, but as I delved into the Bushes and what you call the crime family, the deeper story behind their rise, and actually it turns out that the father, George H.W. Bush, is even more important and more interesting than the son. And the grandfather, very important, even though he's little known, former Senator Prescott Bush, because of their links. You see, basically what I learned was that the Bush family really are, in a sense, figureheads. And they're figureheads for other people that we don't know anything about. We don't even know their names. And so when you read Family of Secrets, there literally are hundreds of characters you're introduced to. Because I thought, we've got to bring these people into the light. We have to show how this actually works. And the way in which democracy has been subverted repeatedly over the course of 50 years. And this actually, it goes into some pretty scary terrain. I won't, pardon the expression, beat around the bush. This has to do with who becomes president, not just the Bushes, but all of them.
Sure.
Who becomes president, who is allowed to become president, what happens to people who are allowed to become president when they wander off the reservation, when they start doing things that displease certain powerful people. Now, if that sounds like fantasy land to anyone listening, I first of all suggest you look at Barack Obama, who is going hat in hand already to powerful banking and Wall Street interests and sort of almost begging their forgiveness and saying, what can I do to make it up to you that, you know, you think that I've been unfair to you, bringing in people like Bill Daley out of J.P. Morgan Chase, very much trying to please those same interests. Obviously, the military-industrial complex that Dwight Eisenhower warned about is so many multiples bigger than it was and more daunting. And on every front, things are worse. By the way, on Who, What, Why, just put up a couple of hours ago our newest article about Obama and nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
And as you pointed out, Mike, Obama was really never the reformer, and he simply couldn't have been. And if you go back and you look at this particular incident involving a large nuclear power supplier based in his state of Illinois, and you see how he said one thing to the voters but actually did another, and essentially allowed the weakening of some crucial measures on the safety around plants in this country. I mean, what could be more important at this time when we're watching this horrific situation in Japan? So we don't have a lot of understanding of power itself. We don't have a lot of understanding of who the people are that we put into the White House. We don't pay attention. We don't do due diligence. We don't vet these people properly. I was always saying, who is Barack Obama? How much do we really know about him? And I'll tell you, Mike, after the research on Family of Secrets, I discovered I didn't even know Richard Nixon. It turned out there was a whole backstory to who he was, mm-hmm. how he came into power, who sponsored him at the beginning. This, I didn't find this in any of those other books that were on my shelves about Nixon. It had all been missed. And the story of what happened with Watergate, completely different story than I thought. And when the book came out and all these people I knew, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist said, wow, you got some really, really hot stuff here. I said, what are we going to do? This is just mind-boggling, and it's terrifying that what we see, that I'll call it a pageant that is played out for us on, sort of CNN and in the major media about this, the process of democracy as we crown our newest king. It's just a fabrication, essentially, and it has nothing to do with the reality.
I doubt seriously if people listening to this program would disagree with you in the least. I think that what you discovered is something that most Americans need to know, A, B, something that most Americans never will fully understand. The function, I believe this with all my heart, the function of television, where most people get most of their news, if it's not talk radio, right-wing talk radio, it would be television. The function of television is to induce forgetfulness. And that's why this laughable phrase, 24-hour news cycle, that's what it's all about. It's to keep it rolling. Don't stop and think. Let me ask you something along the lines of what you're saying. People like Daniel Ellsberg, his release of the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times, people like Julian Assange, his posting of the so-called WikiLeaks documents, for which Bradley Manning is now suffering the tortures of the damned, and that may be literal. How important are Ellsworth's and Assange's now, given what has happened? And I mean primarily in this country, although the WikiLeaks have the documents, the State Department documents, have shown just so much, up to and including this catastrophe in Japan, how U.S. State Department knew that those reactors were in trouble a couple of years ago. How important is Assange and Ellsworth?
First of all, let me say, as far as Dan Ellsberg goes, Dan
Ellsberg,
and I,
I'm sorry.
That's okay, are quite friendly. He's on the advisory board of whowhatwhy.com. I have met Assange. I have had some disagreements with him. My sense is this. In general, I think that we need more information, not less. But I also have to say that I'm a little bit skeptical and wary of the release of large numbers of documents. And the reason I am is because I know that in every institution, documents serve multiple purposes. They're not just somebody candidly expressing what they know to be going on. They often are people trying to avoid responsibility. They're people trying to write what their bosses want to see. They want to cover their posteriors. Sometimes, as particularly with intelligence agencies, they're putting out outright falsehoods. And so the purpose of my work with Family of Secrets and with whowhatwhy.com is to kind of step back from the direction we seem to be going in, which is this rush towards more and faster and more radical swings from one side to the other and the rhetoric and so on, and to call for a slowing down. We're the tortoises, not the hares. We want to look at everything, whether it's documents or statements. We want to step back and look at it very, very carefully and say, what is this thing? Is this real? What is the context? What does this mean? We want to talk to human beings and contextualize those things. So I have very mixed feelings about a lot of the things that are going on right now. And by the way, I'm sure you've seen, Mike, on our site, whowhatwhy.com, we have some material. We were, I think, pretty early out of the box in questioning the situation with NPR, which is another example of the rush to judgment based on something that appeared to to be something.
Right, but doesn't that make an argument? And this would be my argument. These small releases can be more dangerous. If you release 5 million documents, yes, you are going to get a lot of apple polishing or ass kissing, however you want to put it, from low level functionaries within an organization like the State Department. You're going to get people who are writing stuff that is nonsense, but taken in context, I would think that a larger release gives the opportunity for greater context. You can cross reference cables that were released in 2005 vis-a-vis a cable released on the same subject in 2007 and see how the subject has changed. I would tend to believe, Russ, that more documentation. Now, once they are released, once 5 million documents or whatever are put out there, then I think it takes people to who can go contextual. I don't think it is wise for the New York Times or any a news organization to start pulling things out and saying, aha, look at this, aha, look at that. But if the documentation is out there, then people who understand the function of the State Department, it certainly is not to protect U.S. citizens' interests someplace. When the function of the State Department is understood by people who are pay grades way above me, then they can put this stuff into context and we can understand it. I would hold for more releases, not less.
Yeah. You know, I generally agree with you, and I hate to be, in this case, I'm going to have to take the sort of nuanced approach because I think there are a lot of good people working in government at all levels.
Sure, I do too.
There are a lot of good people in the State Department, and one of the problems, frankly, is that diplomacy is the art of the possible. And a lot of those memos that they're writing is they're saying, listen, this guy we're dealing with in this other country seems to be a little bit off their rocker. There is a reason that they don't want all of their things just to come out any more than any of us would like somebody to get in and release. You know, I don't think you'd like it if somebody released all of your diaries and every email you ever wrote.
Russ, hold on a second. I got to do another break. Stay right there if you don't mind. We're talking with Russ Baker, who is the editor of whowhatwhy.com. Please go there. We'll be right back.
Your synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Barry Hall. Thank you, Barry. His message is love to Dolores, Molly, and Sylvester. Thanks, Barry. We're talking with Russ Baker, who's the editor of the website whowhatwhy.com, also the author of the book Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. You know, just for the sake of argument, what you asked Russ about, would I want, you know, all my diaries out? Well, I tell you what, if someone really wanted to understand me, God forbid, yeah, it would all have to come out. You prove that with your book about the Bush family. You went down the rabbit hole. You found out this information, and you just said in the last segment that if we all knew what this whole system of governance, what it really consists of, how people are selected, how they're elected, it might bring about the change that this country desperately needs a lot quicker. So, again, I have to hold on the side of as much exposure as possible. It's, you know, the best fungicide is sunshine or something like that.
You know? The best disinfectant.
There you go.
Well,
that's good, too.
it is to some extent. I guess I see this all as very complicated. For example, I have sitting right in front of me boxes and boxes and boxes of papers about the Bushes. Now, if I just throw those all up on the internet, I don't think it makes anywhere near.
Would you, please?
Yeah,
Russ.
But can I tell you something? I don't think it makes anywhere near the contribution. Most of the time that I spent during those 5 years right. working on Family of Secrets, was trying to figure out what selected documents meant. And this is really the hard work and really the unheralded work of journalism. And whatever you think of, whether it's WikiLeaks or these other outfits that are starting up, what they really are is they are people who went to the public and they said, if you've got documents, give them to us and we will post them on the internet. It's basically a posting service is mm-hmm. what it is. Mm-hmm. It's not journalism. And just even the fact that, now they're calling these people journalists and that they're, you know, speaking to journalists about principles and so forth, it's not a very sophisticated thing.
No, it isn't. It isn't. And I agree with that. And I doubt, I seriously doubt, I don't know, I haven't heard every comment Julian Assange has made, but I doubt if he is referring to himself as a journalist. In fact.
Oh, he is.
Oh, he is.
Absolutely is. Oh, yes.
Well,
yes.
I would completely disagree with that. He is, as you just pointed out, he's someone who posts stuff on the internet. While I agree in massive releases, if we're looking for the truth, then I also agree that there has to be someone, for example, you, Russ Baker, who will take this material, quantify it, qualify it, put it into a form that can be understood. A lot of people talk about, I have, about the role that Prescott Bush had with the bank in New York in funding Hitler. If this is, or funding not Hitler directly, but the Wehrmacht, the Nazi movement, and if it's taken out of context, it is shocking, but it really doesn't make any sense. And I agree with that. It has to be put into context, and I'm sure you got into that when you did the book.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that troubles me, Mike, is just the general growing polarization in this country and the growing lack of information people have. If you look at the numbers of people who post comments for and against, in the extreme, these releases, most of these people don't actually know what they're talking about, and I dare say most of them haven't read more than just a few of the documents themselves.
So sure.
they're in love with the idea of it, or they're in love with the idea of being against it. And the other thing that's very important to think about is any extreme new development like that causes extreme reaction. And, you know, I have to say, I mean, if I were part of the people who want to suppress freedom in this country, I would almost welcome extreme hiccups like that mm-hmm. because it gives an opportunity, and we see this. We see the members of Congress who are saying, you know, not only prosecute him, but prosecute anyone who does it, change the laws, and do. You see, there's a battle right now with the freedom of information law. That, to me, one of the first things we need to do is go through the legal process of making it much more difficult for them to classify documents in the first place, and then begin going about the process. Right now, some of us are pushing for an enhanced release of the documents pertaining to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, for example. Mm. They keep all kinds of things under lock and key that there's no reason anymore. And if more people took an interest, signed the petitions in that regard, I think we would see some very, very tangible changes that you wouldn't see that kind of a reaction. And so that, I guess that's what I'm calling for, is more people to pay attention to what we can do, easily do, actually, within the system. And also to support journalism itself. I mean, there's very little interest in funding. You know that. You know how difficult it is to keep your show on the air. I mean, how sure. difficult it is to fund thoughtful conversations, basic, important research and analysis. People don't respond to it. They respond to the heartstring stuff. They respond to the extremes and the emotions. And that mm-hmm. is, I think, a little bit what we're trying to
Well, I agree with you. And I do believe what Sagan said, that extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. So it's, but we also know what they used to say. What was that program, Kathy? The truth is out there. The X-Files. The truth is out there. Russ, we're flat out of time. It's been a pleasure talking with you. And we'll spend a lot of time on your site. I hope other people will too, and I hope we can chat again sometime. All right.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
All right, Russ. Take care. Take care. Russ Baker, who is the editor of WhoWhatWhy.com, an investigative news website, and also the author of Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, America's Invisible Government, and the Hidden History of the Last 50 Years. Check out his website. And if you haven't gotten the book, why not? All right, we have a break here. We'll come back. Third hour of the program coming up tonight. Again, we are staying away to a certain degree of the story that's dominated everything for the past 4 days, and that is the tragedy, this catastrophe in Japan. There are other things that we need to talk about, or I need to talk about. So stick around. We'll be back. I'm Mike Malloy. Messages, all the usual accolades to Mike and Kathy, salutations to the extended Malloy Radio clan from the Texas Treetop Flyer. Onward through the fog, podcasts are essential help in navigation. Thank you, Terry. Also, this hour, James Higgins is one of our sponsors. Thank you, James. Welcome back. 7 past the hour on the Malloy program. You know, as promised here, some potpourri, or as a teabagger would say, a potpourri. I sometimes find that I can still be shocked about the ignorance and paranoia that so many people in our culture carry with them. It's just astonishing sometimes, you know? I mean, I don't expect people to be religious scholars. I frankly think religion is nonsense. There's some very interesting writings in religion. The essential part of it, though, to me is nonsense. Nonsense. Baloney, malarkey. Which is not to say, I mean, take a look at Roman mythology, Greek mythology, Chinese mythology, Norse mythology, Celtic mythology. Okay, it's all very interesting, isn't it? We don't still believe that Thor is going to hammer us into the ground, though, if we mess up, right? So when you look at biblical stories and mythology, whether it is in the form of Jewish or Christian or Islamic, what's the big deal? Which is all just lead up to this little item I found on CNN. CNN has a belief blog. Did you know that? I'm sorry. Just a belief blog. That just strikes me as funny. And Eric Maripodi is one of the editors there. But he's got just a little item I found this morning. I can't help it. This just cracks me up. Under the headline, Prayers Spark Scare on Airline or on Airplane. Prayers Spark Scare on Airplane. Okay, now what's the first thing you think of? Right? When you hear the headline, well, or you see the headline, first thing, oh my goodness, there are some Muslims in the aisle with their prayer rugs out, right? Wrong. Here's what happened. On last Sunday, three Orthodox Jewish businessmen were on a flight from Mexico City to Los Angeles. They were on Alaska Airlines Flight 241, and the passengers on board this aircraft became alarmed when these three men began to pray out loud. According to an airline spokeswoman, quote, shortly after takeoff, three passengers were praying out loud in a language other than Spanish. The spokeswoman continued, they had something that appeared to the flight attendants to be strapped under their clothing. Bombs! The flight attendants alerted the flight deck, which in turn alerted the tower at LAX, law enforcement, who met the plane upon arrival. End quote. Okay, you got it? They had something strapped under their clothing. Oh, they, what? You see, during weekday prayers, you see, all the three peoples of the book, they pray, you know, on a regular basis, Muslims and Jews and Christians, right? During weekday prayers, some Orthodox Jewish men wear tefillin or phylacteries. These are black leather straps wrapped around the left arm and around the forehead. Well, that's just what they do. And the straps are connected to small boxes with tiny scrolls containing Jewish scriptures. You got that? Many Orthodox Jewish men also wear a prayer shawl called a tallit under their clothes with knotted fringes at each of the four corners. You know, if you've seen pictures of Orthodox Jewish men at synagogue or just, I don't know, walk through certain sections of Midtown Manhattan and, or go to, where is it, Brooklyn now, where the, super Orthodox Jews live. And, you know, it's just, I mean, why don't we know about this? The average person, why doesn't the average person in America at this point know that Christians go to church on Sundays? If they're really devout, they go to prayer meeting on Wednesday. If they're Catholic, they're supposed to go to a mass every day. Jews pray X number of times a week. Muslims pray five times a day. Muslims, you know, when they enter their house of worship, they take off their shoes. Jews cover their heads. Catholic women are supposed to put something. I mean, why don't we know all that? I mean, come on, right? But here we have three Jewish businessmen on a plane chanting Hebrew prayers in, oh my God, Hebrew! and everybody freaks out. An airline spokeswoman said she was unaware if the men were wearing any of the traditional items under their clothing. Well, I don't know if they had on their tefillin. I don't know if they had on their little boxes or their tallits or their... I don't know. When the plane landed at LAX, it was greeted by members of airport police, the FBI, customs officials, and border protection. And according to FBI spokeswoman, the men were questioned. Can you imagine what the questions were about? What are you doing? What is this strange non-Spanish language you are chanting in? What are those little boxes on your head? What are the... Can you see the scene? And their baggage was searched before they were cleared to go. Open up your briefcase! What's in here? What is this stuff? You're religious? I don't see anything religious in here. I see straps and shawls and... According to the FBI spokeswoman, quote, the men were extremely cooperative. End quote. What are they going to be? What are they going to be? And then airline police sergeant so-and-so told CNN there was never any threat to passenger or aircraft safety. Well, that's certainly a relief. Now, on a personal note, the possibly humorous part of the story is if I pronounced any of those terms incorrectly. Tefillin, phylacteries, tallit. Wouldn't that be funny? I will probably hear before this segment is over if I did. But the ignorance and the paranoia of people. Oh my God, they're saying something in a language, and we're just coming from Mexico, and it's not Spanish, and God knows it's not English. What is that? They're making noises. Can you imagine if they would have been Muslim? What would happen if, if three Catholics were on board, and very conservative Catholics were on board an aircraft and started trying to bless the passengers or toss holy water around or raise the cross, and the flight attendant said, and one was raising something. It looked like a club. We'll be right back. Terry Knipe is this hour's sponsor. He writes all the usual accolades to Mike and Kathy from the Texas Treetop Flyer. Onward Through the Fog. Podcasts are essential help in navigation. Thanks, Terry. Also, James Higgins, who is also sponsoring this hour. Thanks, James. 21 past the hour. Speaking of Alaska, that was Alaska Airlines, where the three Orthodox Jewish men were thought to be doing something that we don't understand. And if we don't understand it, of course, it means that they're about to blow the airliner out of the sky, obviously. And everybody has to get sweaty and panic and call for security. Anyway, speaking of Alaska, four leaders of the Fairbanks, Alaska-based group of nutballs called the Alaska Peacekeepers Militia. Have been arrested, charged with conspiring to commit murder, kidnapping, and arson. Alaska Peacekeepers Militia, now in custody, charged with conspiring to commit murder, kidnapping, arson. Well, you know, I'm just a dumb old white boy from Georgia, but that doesn't sound too much like peacekeepers, does it? I mean, here, wait a minute. Let me scratch my head just for a second. Scritch, 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 scritch. Murder, kidnapping, and arson. And they call themselves the Alaska Peacekeepers Militia? Lord have mercy. That sounds like the wrong name. Maybe it should be the Alaska Nutball Association running around in the woods pretending like they're bears or something, right? Federal agents, before they busted these freaks, made extensive recordings of the militia members plotting to kill or kidnap judges and Alaska state troopers, burn their houses. These goddamn screwballs amassed high-powered weaponry, including grenades and 30 and 50 caliber machine guns. They were going to carry out retaliatory strikes against law enforcement. One of this group of halfwits, the leaders of one of this group of halfwits, somebody named Francis Cox, was arrested on a gun charge a year ago but failed to show up for court appearance. According to the criminal complaint, The militia was supposed to, quote, respond to attempts to arrest Cox by responding against state court or law enforcement targets with twice the force and consequences as happened to him or his family. If he was arrested, two state targets would be arrested. If he was killed, two state targets would be killed. If his house was taken, two state target houses would be burned. The plot had progressed to a level where militia members were instructed to, on where to find three state troopers and a state judge. What a bunch of just dumbasses. I mean, what is this? In the state of Alaska, that's bigger than countries around the planet. You dumb bastards, all you can do is run around pointing guns at your ghost. What the hell is wrong with you? Go get a job. Go to work. Go fishing. Go club some baby seals or something. You dumbasses. Alaska Peacekeepers Mission Militia. Really? Murder, kidnapping, arson. Media Matters, that posted this, added that Francis Cox, who doesn't regard state or federal laws as being valid, is part of a sovereign citizens movement, which promotes violent resistance to the federal and Alaska state government. Now, violent resistance, why? Because they are struggling for union rights? No. They're struggling for human rights? No. They're struggling for students to have a good education? No. They're struggling for old people to be taken care of in their sunset years? No. They're struggling for good education? No. Better roads? No, of course not. What are they struggling for? Ah, what are they resisting against the state of Alaska and the federal government? Why? There's a Negro in the White House. There's a black man in the White House. Ooh, Lord have mercy. And they're Jews praying on an airplane. Oh, my God. Two arms. Two arms.
Synchronized screaming. It's Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Of course, you can make a very good case that irony in this culture and this time in this country is dead. There's no such thing as irony. And the proof of that would be the Alaska Peacekeepers Militia conspiring to commit murder, kidnapping, and arson. And four leaders of this group of halfwits busted in Alaska. And as is pointed out, these arrests come just about a year after the arrest of a Michigan-based Christian militia group, which also intended to murder law enforcement officials. And yet, Homeland Security Committee Chairman Peter King, Republican nut ass of Long Island, decided to investigate Muslims and refused to expand his investigation to go after real threats to the United States. The Christians, the crazy white men, the militia bastards. Huh? This really makes sense, doesn't it? Irony. In America? Now? You want to hear some more irony? Yesterday I suggested that you check out defendingwisconsin.org, a website dedicated to punishing the fascists in Wisconsin who are doing what fascists do, and that is destroying representative government and turning it over to corporate pigs. And all this comes, of course, as a result of the efforts of the remaining unionized working class, the public, so-called public sector workers, who have been struggling against this punk fascist, the governor, Walker. Now, there were hundreds of thousands of people out of the population of Wisconsin who have attended these rallies in support of the union workers. A couple of years ago, when he was giving a speech in South Carolina, Mr. Barack Obama had something to say about that.
And understand this, if American workers are being denied their right to organize and collectively bargain when I'm in the White House, I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes myself. I'll walk on that picket line with you as President of the United States of America. Because workers deserve to know that somebody's standing in the corner.
Excuse me? Wait a minute. I had something in my ear. Hold on a second. Okay, let's play that again. Let's try.
Understand this. If American workers are being denied their right to organize and collectively bargain when I'm in the White House,
yeah,
I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes myself. I'll walk on that picket line with you as President of the United States of America.
Wait.
Because workers deserve to know that somebody's standing in the corner.
Wait. Wait a minute. And wait a minute. That must be somebody. Is that Stephen Colbert doing an impression of Barack Obama?
And understand this. If American workers are being denied their right,
yeah,
to organize and collectively bargain when I'm in the White House, I'll put on a comfortable pair of shoes myself. I'll walk on that picket line with you as President of the United States of America. Because workers deserve to know that somebody's standing in the corner.
Yeah, now, wait a minute. That sounded like the president.
Maybe he can't find his comfortable shoes.
That could be. That could be. Haley Barbour has, he wants to be president. Have you seen this guy, this Jabba the Hutt? Have you seen this freak? Haley, let me tell you something. You want to run for president? Okay, there's probably several million people in this country who would vote for you, you porky freak, you Klan-loving white supremacist. You'll get a lot of support, especially over there in Mississippi. But Haley, you got to be careful about the people now. Come on now, you got to be careful about the people who are working from you, like your press secretary, Dan Turner. Come on now, Haley. You're getting into big time now. You're not head of the Republican National Committee anymore. You're not funneling money from the Chinese communists into the hands of the Republican candidates for various offices. It's not the 90s. Come on, Haley. You escaped that bullet, didn't you, pal? Huh? You dodged that one. They almost got your big lardy ass, didn't they, Haley? Almost, but not quite. And we know. almost only counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, right, Haley? All right, now, listen, listen up, listen up. You want to be president, don't you, Haley? Because, well, you're a great leader. You have those leadership qualities, don't you, Haley? Lord, you sure do. You got to be careful about the people that you're hiring now. Your press secretary, Dan Turner, who resigned the other day, yesterday, as a matter of fact, Haley, damn, because of his off-color, let's put it that way, emails about the Japan earthquake and former Attorney General Janet Reno? Lord, you white boys over there in Mississippi, you still like to make old comments about old Janet Reno, don't you? Wasn't that a knee slapper? Huh? Wasn't that Bill Clinton something? He hired Janet Reno to be his attorney general. That gives you white boys over there in Mississippi stuff to talk about for, well, let me see. It's been damn near a decade now, hasn't it? Huh? Woo! Politico's Ben Smith reported on some of Dan Turner's daily email jokes, which last Friday included, hey, did you hear this one? Otis Redding posthumously, that means after you're dead, posthumously received a gold record for his single Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. That's not a big hit in Japan right now. God damn, I'm funny. Here's another one. You ready? Here's another one. In 1993, Janet Reno was unanimously, that means everybody did it, confirmed by the U.S. Senate to become the first female attorney general. Here's the knee slapper part. It took longer than that to confirm her gender than to confirm her law license. Damn, boy, I love them old queer jokes. Oh, Lord have mercy. Woo! Y'all got any more boiled peanuts over her? Last night, Haley Barbour's office released a brief statement saying, quote, Governor Haley Barbour has accepted Dan Turner's resignation as press secretary. Laura Hipp will now serve in that capacity, end quote. Barbour, of course, suggested that the civil rights era wasn't all that bad. Of course, if you are a white boy, large and obese and stuffing your hand in the bacon dripping jar every time you walk past the stove and you got that old pretty blonde hair and everything, I guess it wasn't bad, was it, Haley? He said civil rights era wasn't that bad. He also refused to denounce a KKK leader who was a Confederate general. That would be old Nathan Forrest, you know. And but he did pledge to deny a state license plate honoring him. So the score at this point, well, up until this, was about 3-1 against you, Haley. But I tell you what now, boy, listen up. Listen up, Haley. You got to listen, you big old porky sumbitch, you. You got to listen. If you want to be president, and hell, given the way things are going in this country, you just might be. Well, until you get elected, Haley, you're going to have to be careful about, oh, Negro jokes and gay people jokes and fart jokes and exploding frog jokes and some of that stuff over in Mississippi that is just so goddamn funny. But you know what, Haley? It just doesn't play around the rest of the country. It really doesn't. Doesn't. It really doesn't. All right, Haley? Now get it together. Get together. There's lots of folks out there who just waiting to vote for you, Haley. But Lord have mercy. Watch out who you hire, okay? two, count them, two sponsors. Terry Knight is our first sponsor. All the usual accolades to Mike and Kathy. Salutations to the extended Malloy Radio clan from the Texas Treetop Flyer. Also, James Higgins, who doesn't have a message. Thanks to both of you. 10 before the hour. And then there's this. Wisconsin State Senator, Republican Randy Hopper. Randy Hopper. Okay. Of Fond du Lac. He's the subject. What happened was protesters showed up last Saturday at his house, people protesting what the outside, not at his house, but outside on the public street, showed up protesting what the pig Republicans are doing in Wisconsin. And surprise, surprise, his wife appeared at the door. According to Ross' story, his wife, Mrs. Hopper, comes to the door and tells them, the protesters, that old Randy was no longer living there. In fact, he now lives in Madison, Wisconsin, with his 25-year-old mistress. With his what? His 25-year-old mistress. Hello? What? He doesn't live there anymore. He doesn't live with his wife and kid. Well, my God, that sounds like Rudy Giuliani. 25-year-old mistress. Really? The 25-year-old mistress, that's just an identifying term. I'm not, you know, if it was Mrs. Hopper and she had herself a 25-year-old boyfriend, we'd call him a 25-year-old mister. This is a 25-year-old mistress, okay? No big deal here. Anyway, the young lady is currently employed as a lobbyist for right-wing advocacy group called Persuasion Partners, Inc. Persuasion Partners. We have whips and chains, and we have these boxes we put you in, and when we shut the door, all these little needles prick you. But you know what? She was previously a state Senate staffer who worked on the Senate Economic Development Committee alongside Mr. Hopper. Now, her bio has been scrubbed now from the Persuasion Partners website, but a screen grab is available if you want to go to rawstory.com. They always do this, right? Quick, make her invisible! Quick! God damn it! Oh, woo! Hurry! So, old Randy, there he goes, hopping around. He's got a Randy Hopper. He's got himself a 25-year-old honey. And Miss Hopper's tossed his ass out. But he's a good Christian. He's a good conservative. He's a good Republican. He's like Rudy Giuliani or the rest of these thugs, right? Oh, my God. Senator Hopper has worked closely with Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker to implement the state's new anti-labor laws and enact policies favorable to the interests of big business. Like Walker, old Randy Hopper. Isn't that a name? Isn't that a name for somebody that's out there boinking the women on the side? Randy Hopper. My God. Hey, Randy, you were doomed when they named you, weren't you, boy? Randy Hopper. And we make fun of Haley Barbour. Haley Barbour couldn't hop if somebody put a firecracker under his ass. But this guy, Randy Hopper. Woo! Go, Randy. Oh, my God. Randy Hopper is one of the Republican politicians named in a massive recall effort spirited by Wisconsin Democrats. You can probably get all this information at defendingwisconsin.org. According to Wisconsin law, once you become an elected state official in that state, you have to serve at least 1 year of your current term before you're eligible for recall by voters. So, Randy Hopper. Randy Hopper, I can't get over that name. What is he? Oh, he's a Hopper. He is? Yeah, he's Randy, too. Randy Hopper was elected state senator in the fall of 2008, making him eligible for recall, whereas Governor Walker will not be eligible until 2012. Damn. Blogging Blue, which is where Ross Story got this report, also says that Mrs. Hopper intends to sign the recall petition against her husband. The petition already has been signed by the family's maid. Now, see, if it was Strom Thurmond, a situation like Strom Thurmond, and if the maid were African-American, old Randy Hopper would have been boinking her and having a kid with her. And then, like old Strom did before he went off to meet Jesus, then he could spend his entire life trying to thwart any effort for human rights in this country.
Don't talk to me about human rights. I got to go boink my maid.
So, just in the sense of regional fairness, we've got Haley Barbour in Mississippi who wants to be president. Then we have old Randy Hopper. I can't get over that name. Who no longer lives where he says he lives. He moved out. His wife kicked his ass out when she caught him, in flagrante delicto. And he now lives in Madison with his 25-year-old honey. Oh, my goodness sakes. Isn't politics a hoot? It's just... So, in the interest of regional fairness, for tonight, we have Randy Hopper. I can't get over that name. He's a Randy Hopper. Boing, 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 boing. And old Haley Barbour down there in Mississippi. Boys, you make me disgusted to be an American. You really do. I'll see you tomorrow night. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.